Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, March 1st, 2016. The SPLA-IO makes new demands before sending its troops to Juba.
Our forces cannot go and stay in cantonment areas without, you know, medical care, without food, without, proper sheltering. And this issue is one of the things that needed to be addressed first before they arrive.
And government spokesman says the SPLA-IO is not organized.
The SPLA-IO has not yet submitted the list of their forces up to this moment to the Troika, the EU and the IPF, who were supposed to transport these soldiers to Juba. The reason is not because of anything other than their failure to organize and submit the list.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The Sudan People's Liberation Army in opposition is making fresh demands before its forces will come to Juba. SPLA-IO says so far the government has no clear containment areas for its forces in Juba. The former rebels say its forces will only come to Juba once containment areas are clearly designated and life support facilities are in place for those forces. Waki Simon Wudu reports for VOA from Juba.
Last month, the SPLA-IO said logistical challenges, including transportation, hindered its forces from coming to Juba. In the meantime, the Troika countries, the United States, the United Kingdom, and Norway have offered to transport the SPLA-IO forces to Juba. The SPLA-IO insists its forces still won't arrive in Juba this week as expected. Major Dixon Galuaka, deputy spokesperson of the SPLA-IO, says other issues are preventing the forces from coming to Juba.
One of them is the basic life support, as you have seen. Without the water, our forces cannot go and stay in cantonment areas without, medical care, without food, without, proper sheltering. And this issue is one of the things that needed to be addressed first before they arrive.
During a recent meeting organized by the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, or JMEC, the two warring parties agreed that a force of 1,370 of Machar's forces would be sufficient for his security and that other troops would arrive later after formation of the transitional government of national unity. But Galwak says much remains to be done before the opposition forces can land in Juba.
When we talk of the location, from Pagar to Gambela, because our forces are going to pass to Ethiopia. Then the Ethiopian government need to approve, the transit of weapons from region, arrive from the airport and then to Juba. Because our forces may not, they cannot come into through Ethiopia without final approval from the Ethiopian government. This one now, it is being coordinated and it is underway. And at the same time, the movement of the forces arrive from Pagar to Gambela, it may take like 3 days. That is four for the second group. They have to move again using River Nile by bikes from Kaldak to Malakal town. So it may need some days.
Gadluak says the same holds true in Malakal. He says the SPLA-IO must move using the River Nile by barges from Kaldak to Malakal town, so it could be several days. The SPLM former detainees and some members of the civil society groups that were part of the peace negotiations in Addis Ababa declined to comment on these latest demands of the SPLA in opposition. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
The South Sudan government says SPLA-IO is looking for excuses for not sending their troops to Juba on Tuesday, as demanded by IGAD Plus and JMAC. Information Minister Michael Makui tells VOA's James Batty the SPLA-IO are not organized and are using delay tactics to block the formation of the transitional government of national unity.
Well, what I know is that the SPLA-IO has not yet submitted the list of their forces up to this moment to the Troika, the EU and the IPF, who were supposed to transport these soldiers to Juba. The reason is not because of anything other than their failure to organize and submit the list. Movement of the forces outside Juba since last week, and the process is continuing. However, we have slowed down because of the delay in the coming of the SPLM-IO forces, because we cannot leave Juba without security. This is why we have slowed down, and we will continue to phase out. As soon as they begin to arrive, then we'll phase out completely so that they and the remaining SPLA forces and the police would continue to maintain the security of Juba. This is what we are doing. The main issue is not the absence of food, of non-preparation of the site for their accommodation, but the main problem is on the side of the SPLM-AIO, which failed to give the list of these soldiers, NCOs, officers, NCOs and men, to the Troika, to the EU and to the IPF, who are supposed, after the receipt of the list and the type of armaments they have, then they transport them to Juba. The list is not given up to now. How are they expected to be transported without? The problem is not their food. It is not their accommodation. That is not their problem. It is our responsibility, and we have done all the necessary arrangements.
They also mentioned, Mr. Minister, that they have not been guaranteed the process, what they call the process of verification on the part of the Ethiopian government when they are passing or bringing their light weapons through Ethiopia. That process of verification has not been guaranteed.
Well, how can it be guaranteed at a time when they have not given the list? The list of armaments that they have, but they have not given it up to now. Not the list of the armaments, even the list of the personnel who are supposed to be transported have not been given.
So this can be another delay in the implementation process, is that correct?
Yeah, definitely. It is another delay, and the delay this time is on the side of the IO.
That's South Sudan Information Minister Michael Makui speaking to VOA's James Batty from Juba earlier today. Residents of Wau Town say more than 15 young men were arrested from their homes, tortured and killed by some unidentified members of security forces. State officials are calling for an independent investigation into the killings. Charlton Doki reports for VOA from Juba.
Residents say some of the bodies of the youth were found in Bagari Jedid residential area, just a few kilometers away from the Wau Busere Road near a cemetery southwest of Wau Town. Eyewitnesses say some of the youth were beheaded. A resident who fled the area says several youth from the area are in hiding for fear of being kidnapped or killed. Speaking in Arabic, the resident willing to have her voice recorded but declined to be identified by name for fear of reprisals, accuses the South Sudan Army of carrying out the killings.
Young boys aged between 12 and 14 has been arrested and slaughtered. We used to hear gunshots those days, but these days we cannot hear anymore. They take them behind there with their hand tied behind and slaughtered them. Soldiers came in the resident, arrested the civilians, and killed them.
Another eyewitness, who also spoke on condition of anonymity for fear of government reaction, alleges that the army targets a particular tribe by first arresting them, then killing them for no good reason.
There are bodies of those killed them, some with guns, and some others slaughtered them. As I speak, I have a lot of fear of my life.
But SPLA acting spokesperson Lieutenant Colonel Marco Mayol denies the allegation that those killing the youth are government soldiers. He accuses former rebels and criminals of being behind the violence.
Those of us are wearing uniform of the SPLA group, and also civilian and the criminal, they are wearing uniform of the SPLA and have the same criminal activities, and they call themselves, they are SPLA. But what I know to the SPLA soldiers or SPLA personnel, their mandate to protect civilians and their property. So I don't think that one of the SPLA personnel can go and remove the one of the civilians in the house and slaughter that one. So I don't think that one is true. If there is evidence, let them bring that full details, the name of the somebody who committed, and when and where.
State Governor Elias Wayanyi Poch says the government is aware of the disappearance and killings of some youth. He says the government is investigating the killings and working to recover the bodies. Governor Nyipoch describes the security situation in Wau as very complicated. He says even some members of the police force are disappearing under unclear circumstances.
Those of prison and fire brigade and wildlife, they have lost even their staff. They have lost even some of their staff in names. But whom can you accuse? I did not see dead bodies. Maybe it is yesterday, one that we, it was my car that went and brought the dead body of that young boy. I think his head was not there. And there is another one, but it was the gimmicks that came yesterday in my office. There is no way for me to deny this. And if those who are disappearing are taken by night or in a car, then I cannot know. No one will tell me. If I ask, no one is giving me any report about it.
Governor Nyipoch acknowledges that there are parallel commanding units giving orders to the army in the area, something he says complicates security matters. He says the forces operating in the area where the youth are being killed receive their orders directly from Juba. Asked whether these forces are a government militia group working hand in hand with the SPLA command, he had this to say.
Those of Division 5, I asked them, who are those forces deployed in those positions? They said these soldiers are from sector headquarters. I did not get one of their sector headquarters, so that I asked him directly.
A 10-member committee from the national government is expected to arrive in Wau to investigate the cause of insecurity and the killings of civilians. Nyipoch says he is confident the criminals operating in the area will be identified and brought to justice.
Investigation committee is coming from Juba. What is good, the members are non-Barghazalian. The seven members of this committee, they all come from Upper Nile and Equatoria.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Juba.
Dimo Silva Aurelio prepared that report from Wau. And there's been killings in the new state of Yei. Authorities have recovered two bodies of Ugandan businessmen killed by unknown gunmen on the Yei Maridi Road. Police officials say the decomposed bodies were found in the forest in Mambe. VOA fellow Tito Justin reports from Yei.
The police commissioner for Yei River State says the bodies were burned and he identified the two Ugandans as Kalisa Ismail and Doka Noah. Jeremiah Maker says four people were killed in the attack which occurred last month on the road to Maridi State. Maker says he is shocked by the recent killing in the area.
The two got here first were bent near the vehicle of the company dealing with cigarettes. The first force that went to bring them could not get them because the two Ugandans were picked and killed in a distance of 500 meters from the main road. So when we heard about them, we went yesterday to bring them.
Kalisa and Doka were employees of Kabak, a Ugandan company dealing in cigarettes distribution. The two Ugandans were killed on their way to deliver a consignment of cigarettes to Maridi. Their vehicle was burned down into ashes. Jean-Pierre Samputu is the manager of Kabak. Samputu thanked the Yei police for recovering the bodies of his employees.
We thank them very much because we are under pressure to get them all these days. Now, fortunately, we have got them. Even their family members, they are already informed. They are already at the border, waiting for them so that they can take them and bury them as per their different traditions.
Governor of Maridi State, Colonel Africano Mandi, says the area where the incident took place is now calm.
There's constant patrol, and that has been happening, trying to seal some of the routes that are being used by this group. And at the same time, the security agencies continue to investigate and pursue the people who are considered to be involved in that particular incident.
Mandi says couples of suspects were arrested but were released for lack of evidence or involvement in the killing of the two Ugandan businessmen. South Sudan depends on goods from Ugandans. Governor Mandi says Ugandan business people should not be discouraged by the incident. But Ugandan nationals have complained about harassment and killing of their nationals in South Sudan. Uganda, Kenya and Ethiopia hosts millions of South Sudanese refugees who fled from South Sudan following the fighting that erupted in Juba in December 2013. Most senior South Sudanese government officials have relocated their families to Uganda, Kenya, where there are good schools and basic services. For VOA News, I am Tiro Justin in Yei.
Gift Friday contributed to that story from Juba. You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, what are South Sudanese doing to mark World Zero Discrimination Day? Find out when we return.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
which African country do you admire most?
I admire Nigerians. They are very bold and they are go-getters.
I admire DRC Congo because of their music. They perform the best of music ever in Africa. Even though you don't understand what their language, but you admire their music.
I admire Ghana. It's my country, it's my motherland. Moreover, the culture of Ghanaians are unique. We are also very, very hospitable.
I love my country, South Sudan, and I'm so proud of it, despite of the ongoing ups and downs.
I admire Botswana, because Botswana is a good country, it's a cool country. You know, they don't have this other corrupt, other things that are happening in other countries. They're like just like Switzerland in Europe, yeah.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. It's time for our Tuesday health segment. Today we are talking about AIDS and discrimination. Today is World Zero Discrimination Day, which celebrates everyone's right to dignified life regardless of gender, sexuality, nationality, race, or illness. South Sudan health officials are using the day to call for an end to discrimination towards people living with HIV/AIDS. Mungome Devs Rwakarinj reports from Juba.
Evelyn Latio heads a local NGO, National Empowerment of Positive Women United, which advocates for the rights of women living with HIV. Latio says many people living with the disease are stigmatized in their communities. Latio says discrimination in South Sudan is widespread.
At family level, we have had these incidences where those family members that are positive can be rejected by the family members. We have so many cases where those that were positive reported to us that their own mothers, their own brothers will not eat together with them in the same plate. And whenever they use a cup for drinking, it is thrown in the latrine. Whenever they use a plate for eating, it is thrown in the latrine because they fear they would also get HIV.
Latio says some people don't even want to be tested for HIV because they are more afraid of the stigma attached to the disease than the effects of not being treated.
We also had incidences where a girl whose mother died, she was 3 years old and she was positive. The father died, the mother died. And when the mother was being buried, the uncles wanted to bury her alive.
According to the South Sudan HIV and AIDS Commission, around 2.7% of South Sudan's estimated 12 million people are living with HIV. That means at least 190,000 people in the country are living with AIDS. In 2013, UNAIDS estimated that 35 million people worldwide were living with HIV. The organization also said 2.1 million people became newly infected with the virus and 1.5 million people died from AIDS-related illness that year. This year's theme is Stand Out and Encourage Everyone to Stand for Fair and Just Societies. Juba resident Margaret Pony lives with her sister Angelina, who tested positive for HIV 16 years ago. Pony says people living with HIV should be treated fairly.
She's part of our life, of the family, and she has to be there. Because if we try to make her annoyed, maybe she will make a suicide. Then it will be a loss to us.
Angelina, a single mother of three, says life can be challenging for people living with HIV. But she says she's able to cope after having opened up about her HIV status.
I take them to school, to the church. During Christmas, we go together. So we celebrate their birthday together. We are living a happy life, actually.
Habibu Dafala Awongo is Director General for Program Coordination at South Sudan's HIV and AIDS Commission. He says stigma and discrimination delays the effort to fight the disease.
You know, the impression people have is that once you are HIV positive, you are like an outcast, you know, and at the same time, it's like you're somebody who's dying anytime soon.
Dafala Aongo says people can live longer once they're on antiretroviral drugs. Aongo says the commission will hold talk shows on different radio stations to teach people to support rather than discriminate against people living with HIV. Earlier this year, the Global Fund approved $40 million US dollars to fight HIV/AIDS in the country. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Ruakarinj in Juba.
From Juba, we move to Zimbabwe, which is one of the four South African countries rolling out free HIV testing kits this month. Experts say making it easier for people to find out their status will curb the spread of HIV. But others worry that testing without adequate counseling and treatment options will have little impact. Sebastian Maofu reports from Harare.
Zimbabwe is optimistic that self-testing kits can help it prevent new HIV infections. A quick thumb prick, and in a matter of minutes, the test kit can tell you if you are HIV positive or not. The test kits are already available in some pharmacies. They cost about $5. But a new program funded by the international NGO UNITAID will soon begin distributing them for free over the next 4 years so researchers can evaluate their effectiveness. Zimbabwe's National HIV Prevention Coordinator, Gertrude Ncube, says the self-testing kits are convenient and discreet.
When you look at self-testing, it has got an advantage in saying that those who are even afraid of maybe for someone to know their HIV status, they'll be able to test themselves and interpret the results themselves at their home environment. Basing on other studies which have been done somewhere like in Malawi, it was found that men were actually forthcoming with self-testing. So we are hoping that even here in Zimbabwe, especially men who are always busy at work, they'll be able to get the self-tests and test themselves.
Only 34% of men in Zimbabwe know their HIV status compared to 56% for women. In some African countries, the percentage of men who know their HIV status can be as low as 8%. In theory, once people know they're infected, they can begin treatment and learn how not to transmit the virus to others. But some Zimbabweans are skeptical. The self-test kits are not a magic bullet, says Maya Maponga.
As soon as I get to know my results, what do I do? From then, there is no adequate counseling. Let's not just assume that everybody is in the know about HIV. Yes, we want to take it like we want to normalize HIV, but in the process, it's not that like as normal as we would want it to be. If, yeah.
Stefano Goodcare works with Population Services International, one of the organizations running the HIV self-testing program in Zimbabwe.
Community health workers, they are going to be available to assist people that might test regardless of their results. If they need further information, they need support, even assistance with interpreting their own results or what options they can follow after testing. We also have a toll-free line that people can call and speak to a counselor at any time. And this should be able to provide further support to people that test.
Malawi, South Africa, and Zambia are also taking part in this initiative. At the moment, Kenya is only other African country to have officially adopted HIV self-testing kits, though they can be found for purchase in other countries like Namibia and Tanzania. Of the approximately 34 million HIV-positive people worldwide, 69% live in sub-Saharan Africa. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
And now for some U.S. news. Today, American voters in 13 states and other U.S. territories are headed to the polls to vote their favorite party candidates. Ian Bior caught up with two South Sudanese Americans in the U.S. state of Virginia who say they have been waiting for this day for a long time.
Super Tuesday is the name given to a pre-scheduled Tuesday during the U.S. presidential primary election when the largest number of states vote for the candidate they want to run for president in the general election. Super Tuesday is important to many voters because it narrows the field in the choices for the presidential candidate by helping to eliminate contestants who do not receive enough delegates to secure the nomination. Among the multitude of voters who are lining up today are two naturalized citizens from South Sudan. Both say that today is the defining day which will set a precedent for the presidential elections in November. Mark Cody, who is originally from South Sudan and lives in the East Coast state of Virginia, which is holding a primary today, says this election will define the American story, and he wants his vote to count.
You know, voting is very important for me because I see it as a kind of a voice. As an American citizen, it's a voice and it's a chance for me to be heard. You know, all the elected officials that we elect usually, we can hold them accountable basically for the decision that they make while they're serving us. And it's crucial that they know that without our votes, they cannot be there.
That same spirit is driving Virginia resident Thone Moses to the polls today. The traditionally Republican voter says he's largely disappointed in the caliber of candidates this election season, although he plans to vote for Republican Marco Rubio. He says Republican discussion on immigration has largely been distasteful, which bothers Moses, who is a former refugee. He's particularly annoyed with Republican candidate Donald Trump, who has suggested banning all Muslims from entering the country. Moses worries that Trump's anti-immigration rhetoric will lead to a call against all immigrants.
I kind of see him also as very reckless. And I think I haven't really seen those presidential qualities in him. You know, he's a little bit arrogant. He overlooks people. He will try to belittle people. And it's just like, you know, that's not the kind of person that really wants to represent you outside. He's loud. And it's just like, you know, when you look at some of the security-related issues, you need somebody that has, you know, track record in leadership. So that alone has been very frustrating for me.
Moses says he hopes his fellow Republicans will band together to make sure Trump is not on the ticket come Election Day this November. But he also acknowledges Trump's popularity among voters only seems to grow by the day. He says he thinks Trump has gained popularity for his demonstrated lack of political correctness while speaking publicly and his quick tongue, which often offends more than it compliments. Moses says he will vote for the candidate who is respectful but tough and straightforward and has the most experience when it comes to immigration.
And that's why I kind of leaned toward Rubio, because there was he was part of the group that worked on the immigration documents about 2 years ago. And he was able to work with both Democrats and independent and Republican. And they were able to come up with, you know, partial documents. It was not a complete document. So it seemed like he also, you know, understand the importance of immigrants.
With 81 delegates, Trump, who has vaulted to prominence due to his many business ventures and celebrity television show, continues to lead in the polls, surprising many analysts. Senator Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio are tied for second, trailing Trump by a large margin. The Republican nominee will need more than 1,200 delegates to secure the nomination for the Republican Party. On the Democratic side, former U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton leads liberal candidate Senator Bernie Sanders in the polls. The triumphant Democratic nominee needs more than 2,300 delegates to secure the nomination. Cody says he knows that each vote is critical and hopes his vote for Clinton will help her win the Democratic nomination. He says Clinton is the only candidate who has experience in foreign policy and domestic affairs.
And of course, on top of that, she's a woman, and it will be good also to see a woman for the first time because America, for 200 years, we have always had men as president, but we have never seen a woman. So I think it can be also a good thing.
Virginia has 144 delegates that are up for grabs tonight. Republican candidates can obtain up to 49 delegates in Virginia, while Democratic candidates have 95 delegates. The candidate with the largest amount of delegates will win their party's nomination to run for president in November. For VOA News, I'm Ayan Bior in Washington.
And that's our show for this Tuesday. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Remember to join us tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.